So now that we've explored several aspects of working with a chronic blamer or with clients who try to solve their problem by changing someone else, now I'd like to tilt the lens a little bit and look at how can we, as practitioners, make sure that we're encouraging change rather than requiring it or enforcing it with our clients. You see, according to Dr. Stephen Porges, therapists sometimes fall into certain strategies that can have an underlying agenda of changing people. So here Stephen will share one way to begin shifting out of that kind of strategy. He'll also get into how he distinguishes between pushing a client versus empowering a client.
Well, given this notion of an agenda to change other people, there are therapists who also have that same agenda. And, you know, where they want to, quote, create this dialogue with the agenda of changing the client. And so I think there's some similarity in strategies here. And I want to, in a sense, shift the strategy, give it a different set of words, a different narrative. And so if we think of therapy as a therapist, not as a maker or a changer of people, but as an enabler and supportive to enable someone to emerge and become an enabler, I think if we then enable our clients with that same model, rather than everything would be good if my husband were different or my boss were different or if my son was this or my daughter was this, basically use the therapeutic setting as a way of developing a sense of that individual's power in relationships as an enabler. So an enabler in the positive way, not an enabler for bad behavior or addictive behavior. Enabler meaning a person who witnesses, a person who supports, a person who is accepting, a person who is present. And the model there is when a client starts to obtain those attributes, their relationship with other people spontaneously changes. So they're no longer in a defensive, hostile interaction. They're now in a welcoming set of behaviors that become co-regulatory and supportive. I guess let me add one other comment here, and that is many individuals feel that if they enable, they're being exploited. And this is part of that dialogue that life would be different if someone else were different. And the issue is there is immediately a sense of defensiveness, and their bodies and their language is all about defending who they are, justifying who they are and what they've done. And they haven't had the, let's say, sufficient experiences with feeling safe enough with another person to have that moment of presence, the ability to witness another, and above all, to co-regulate and share those intersubjective moments.
Now, the co-regulation is key here, but often it's not an easy task. That's because, according to Stephen, when a client starts talking about changing others, they've often already built a wall of separation. And so they're predisposed to closing off and holding other people at a distance. And here's how that can sometimes touch off a harmful interaction between a practitioner and a client in a session.
So the notion of co-regulation, the notion of empowering and having therapeutic presence, these are tough tasks, especially with individuals like clients who may be very, very defensive and hypervigilant and not getting cues to the therapist of welcoming and shared moments, because the therapist is human as well. And so the therapist in this whole interaction is going to be reacting to the client. Needs a lot of, let's say, self-love, self-compassion to understand the functional abuse that many therapists are experiencing in their sessions when their client is not sharing with them, not engaging. If the client gaze averts, talks in a monotone, doesn't seem to, in a sense, witness the therapist's presence, the therapist is going to physiologically react to that in a defensive way. The therapist may turn off, may turn away, may drop the affective, positive affect on their face, may start responding, and the client will see that as part of the real world that they're in and support their defensiveness. And then the therapist will be another one of the people in the client's world that doesn't get them, doesn't understand them.
So as Stephen pointed out, helping a client co-regulate can be challenging, but it can also be the key difference between pushing change on a client versus giving them the resources and the space to move toward making that change themselves. Now, of course, that's not the only corrective step we might take if we realize there's a flaw in how we're working with a client whose goal is to change someone else. So here Dr. Rick Hansen has a story about when this happened to him. He'll share the strategy that he used to help put therapy back on track.
I'm thinking there of a client I've worked with quite a lot who has been very, very focused on getting her husband to change in the course of a long relationship that has ultimately led to a separation now, and also get her adult children to change. And I went through multiple cycles of, you know, of her coming in and saying, I know this is crazy, blah, blah. I agreed with her. Yeah, it's not a really good thing. And then we would problem solve around it. And then she'd come back the next week, same issue. And after a handful of cycles of that, I started to pull out of the script she and I were getting caught in. So in effect, I was doing to her what she was doing in her life. And that right there is a really powerful moment. When you start realizing that you're being drawn into enacting yourself as a therapist, what it is you're trying to change or help or be therapeutic about in the other person. And I was trying to get her to change. So what I did is what therapists do is I popped up to the level of commentary. I started observing that was what was happening with supporting factors around that helped her not feel that I was criticizing her or shaming her. It was more out of amusement. And I did deliberate things to disclose my own process with her, which I could do because she's pretty high functioning all the way around. And also did the thing that I think is quite helpful for therapists to do, to go a little bit one down. So one down is it's a very effective method as a way in which to offer an observation about what's happening or even an interpretation of what's happening. And if the therapist goes one down, it makes it easier for the client often to receive it because then it doesn't feel like going one up about them with some kind of power move or, you know, reenactment of their history of being criticized by authority figures. So to talk about how I did it actually concretely, I would often sort of laugh at myself or be rueful, or I'd say, man, I realize it's just so silly. They talked about it in grad school, and there I am again, trying to give you advice and tell you how to do something better. And you know, it just kind of reminds me in a funny way of what you're talking about in here that you're doing with your own children.
Silence.
And then I would just leave it to the person. Self-deprecating, kind of little humor, or another form of one down is to not act like you're sure, but to say, you know, this is probably a dumb idea, but see if any part of it rings true to you, which is that maybe what's happening between us is that I'm getting drawn into doing what you're doing with your kids. Or another version of that that would be more direct, say, would be something on the order of, well, you know, this is a really, really, really tricky thing to talk about, and I'm probably off base here, but I wonder if it might be possible that with your husband, say, that what you're doing with him is something that, hypothetically, you did with your very, very, very first husband, the one who was so much trouble for you, father of your children and so forth. So there's a kind of diffidence in it. I guess that's how I would do it. What happened there in part, the other thing that was really useful with her was to call out and honor her longings for healthy, happy life. She was heroic I think very often when people get caught up in trying to fix others around them, even if it looks like a kind of blaming, if you will, like, well, I'd be happy only if they were different in some way. Deep down, often, it's like there's a quest inside, which was grounded for her in her own really shattered childhood, in which things were broken down. Her father was really critical. Her mother was critical as well as helpless in many kinds of ways. She herself became the so-called parentified child, in which she was supposed to manage her family as a child. She couldn't do it. So we had a classic situation in which her responsibilities are enormous, but her ability to fulfill them as a 10-year-old girl in this messed up family are very, very limited. And then that pattern of relatedness in which she has limited power and influence, and yet she's trying to solve problems that are enormous. You know, she has 10 units of influence and 100 units of a problem. That was brought into her situation with her adult children, who individually had serious organic issues in their psychology, as well as in her marriage, in which her husband, her second husband, just would not budge. And so what was really important for me to do was to get out of trying to budge her and shift her and join with the longing in her for a happier life and a happier family, and to join with the quest in her, the intention in her to repair and heal and make things better in her family. And I think when she when she could see in me, and she could even see in her, the beauty, the power, the heroism of her attempts to do something that was just impossible, then it was easier for her to see that it was impossible. It reminded me a little bit of the classic story of the little Dutch boy in the dike. So the seas are rising and the holes are in the dike, and he's trying to plug all the holes, and you only have so many fingers and toes, and at some point it's just bigger than anything you can do. And yet there's something so endearing and poignant and touching about that little kid trying to plug all the holes in the dike. And when she felt that from me, that I really, really honored and did not patronize or condescend that heroic impulse in her, and that when she could feel inside herself that there was something profound and beautiful and sweet about it, then it was possible to go through a cycle of grief and disenchantment, in which she realized and had to face, no, the ocean is too big for me. It's going to flood the dike. No, I cannot rescue my children from those things. No, my current husband will never be that guy. He will never be that guy that I had flickers of with him. He will never be that guy. He's moved on in various ways that I've given him dozens and dozens of chances, and he refuses to shift in even really easy ways. There's a lot of grief in her to really face that. But to be able to face that, it was really important to first truly honor her heroic impulse.
So by zeroing in on a client's good intentions for trying to make things better, we can often help them start to accept the things they cannot change. I hope you've enjoyed these extra program bonuses and that you found something useful to help you in your work with your clients. Once again, thank you for participating in this program. And if you'd like to check out even more programs that can help you get better outcomes for your clients, please visit us at www.nicabm.com. I'll see you soon.